Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's Podcasts. In this episode, we'll be continuing Northern Heights, Climbing North America's Highest Peaks, Chapter 1, Touching Greatness, Denali, 1963. In Part 1, we got to the Kehiltna Glacier. Now, we simply have to climb the mountain. Of course, climbing the mountain would not be so simple. Ready, shoot, aim. June 20 dawned clear, and our first day on the mountain began with bravado. In a tour de force, we planned on using the sled to move all our supplies 10 miles up to Kehiltna Pass at the head of the Kehiltna Glacier. When Dick and I had discussed our plan with the veteran Dick McGowan in Seattle, he politely pointed out that we were nuts. He said, "You don't understand the distances up there. It's not like going for a run around Green Lake. You just can't make the same time that you make in Colorado or even in the Cascades. You better plan on a camp halfway to the pass and on doing at least one relay." I stammered in disbelief, "But that would require 4 days to get to the pass." McGowan replied, "That's right." We were young and out to prove McGowan wrong. We knew the key was to take just what we needed, but no more. We had 28 days of food in 14 5-gallon cans. Since our college budgets didn't allow us the luxury of flying out with Sheldon, we cached 4 food cans and some fuel at the landing strip for our planned walkout to Talkeetna. Then we loaded up huge packs and put everything else on the sled. Our packs weighed 80 pounds apiece, and the sled had 300 pounds in it. There was one food can left, which Dick picked up and strapped to his pack with much macho blustering. He baited us with, "You Colorado boys are wimps. The weather is always good there, so you never have to carry anything. In the Cascades, where the weather is tough, we heroes carry big packs." Dick's pack was now over 100 pounds, and I said, "I believe in applauding heroes at the end of the show, not the beginning, so I'll talk to you tonight." We put on our snowshoes, roped up, and pushed off. The first mile was glorious, since we went downhill to reach the Kehiltna at 6,800 feet. Because of the crevasse danger, we marched along in single file, spreading out at even intervals along our special 200-foot rope. Our sled coasted along in our tracks with almost no effort on our part as the entire expedition cruised along in the sun. This is what we had dreamed about. We were doing it. Our bubble burst when we got to the Kehiltna, started uphill, and the sled bogged down in the deep snow. We pushed, we pulled, we tried several different rope riggings. We just about blew our guts out, but we could not get the 300-pound sled to go uphill. We had no choice but to leave it behind, and we planned to return for it the next day. We marked it carefully with some of our 4-foot wands. "Well," I reasoned, "at least we can still make the pass in 2 days." Free of the sled, we took off up the glacier with renewed vigor and soon had our second surprise. Distances were indeed deceptive here. Since there were no trees or man-made objects to give scale, the smooth glacier easily fooled our eyes, and we marched as if on a treadmill. I led, bashing down the deep snow with powerful strides, while the others packed it down even more. We left a trough 2 feet deep behind us. After 2 hours, we stopped, consulted the map, and learned that we had only covered a little over a mile. Used to going a mile in 4.5 minutes, Mike cried, "A 1/2 mile per hour!" After applying a McGowan factor, I still figured we could make 1 mile per hour with the sled. Damn. I noticed Dick was not using the waist belt on his frame pack to transfer weight from shoulders to hips. When I asked him why he wasn't using it, he just hollered, "Belts are for wimps." I put in a wand every rope length to guide us back along the trail in a whiteout. When the last man on the rope got to the wand, he sang out, "Wand!" So not only did I have to break trail, I also had to fuss with the wands. I quivered them in my pack and became adept at fishing out a new bunch without breaking stride. I carried my ice axe in my right hand and the wands in my left hand. The paint on the bamboo tomato stakes left my hands a bright green. As chief wand man, my load got steadily lighter, and I learned to place the fattest wands first to maximize the decline. It was small compensation for breaking trail, but it occupied my mind on the long march. As I led on through the deep snow, I became completely absorbed in the effort of leading and the task of going in a straight line. At first, I had a hard time keeping the march straight, and my tracks looked like a drunk's. With a little practice, my track sobered up, and I was able to go for a half mile before looking back to admire my row of wands in a perfect line. Occasionally, the snow settled for hundreds of feet around us with a sickening thump. This is a sign of weak layers in the snowpack, but in the thump instant, we were never sure if we were about to plunge into a crevasse. The map indicated the worst crevasse patterns, and we plotted a course up the glacier designed to miss them. In 3 more hours, we had only covered another 2 miles, and Dick prevented any discussion about what we should do by loudly proclaiming, "I can't take another step. We've got to camp here." I couldn't resist hollering, "Hey, hero, we're still a mile short of where we want to be. You should have used the wimp belt, you wimp." The good-natured banter helped us as we pitched camp at 7,400 feet. Our net altitude gain for the day was only 100 feet, and we were less than halfway to the pass. Clouds brewed up late in the day, denying us a view of Denali. The next morning, Dick declared himself sick, probably from his stupid overexertion. The good news was that Joff, Mike, and I blasted down the trail to our sled in 1 hour. The bad news was that we had to move 300 pounds with only 3 of us instead of 4. We put half the sled load into our packs and rigged the sled so that 2 people pulled and 1 pushed. I got stuck with the push end, which turned out to be a raw deal, as I ended up doing more than 1/3 of the work. Nevertheless, we set upon the project like the well-oiled track team that we used to be, and the sled soon scooted up the glacier with much shouting, sweating, and swearing. In spite of a whiteout and fresh snowfall, we made a non-stop run and roared into camp frothing. Our rapid round trip impressed Dick, and he made no further Colorado wimp jokes. Nevertheless, we would leave the sled here since it had not helped us. The morning hours of June 22 were gloriously clear, and we had our first views of Denali since leaving the Southeast Fork. The Great One rose behind the Kehiltna Peaks and still seemed impossibly high. The Indians had named it well, and the mountain needed only one adjective, great. The sound of Sheldon's cub buzzing up the glacier interrupted our solitude. He wagged his wings at us, but we had no way to talk to him. Landings are not permitted inside the park except in emergencies, and we assumed that something was wrong with either the McGowan or Canadian parties that were ahead of us on the route. We hoped it was not serious. Seeing Sheldon's flight intensified our eagerness to reach the pass and find out what was going on, but when we reached 8,500 feet, it socked in again and snowed hard. Nevertheless, we kept going using compass readings to find our route. Joff led while I worked the compass, and I quickly discovered that without correction, Joff veered to the left while leading into the whiteout. He walked forward in a great white globe like a blind man, while the rest of us could see Joff, the rope, and the tracks, which made it easier for us to judge a straight line. I compared the compass bearing with the tracks line and kept correcting Joff. I had to hold the compass in my hand and take readings every few steps to keep us on course. The leader's missteps seemed pitiful, but if anybody complained, he got to lead and see for himself what it was like to be on the sharp end of the rope. Since you can plunge into a crevasse with any step, you strain looking for clues but find none. After a while, your equilibrium goes, you adopt a stumbling step and circle one way or the other. People really do go in circles when lost. My altimeter nailed down the third dimension, and I took readings every 15 minutes. When we reached 9,000 feet, it started to blow and snow in earnest, so Mike and I got the map out of his pack. We had protected our maps in plastic for just such an event. We turned our backs to the wind to read the maps and quickly saw that we had only covered 3 of the remaining 5 miles to the pass. There was no way we could push another 2 miles into this maelstrom. This felt like a real storm, and remembered Sheldon's advice. Storm? Hunker down. Clear? Go like a jackrabbit. We quickly made a cache for our loads, then taped some 4-foot wands together to make a 7-foot wand. We pushed the 7-footer into the snow, leaving 4 feet exposed. We had to find this cache later, or our climb would be crippled. Relying on the wands that we had placed on the way up, we turned and did a snowshoe shuffle trot back to camp. The next day it stormed hard and we hunkered down. We welcomed the rest after our exertions of the last 3 days and enjoyed eating, reading, and cracking jokes. We lived in an appropriately named McKinley tent, which had a 6 by 8 foot floor and a single center pole. Since we were college students used to living in basement hovels, the cramped tent did not bother us. In the late evening it cleared. I stood up in the tent, peeked out the tiny vent at eye level, and saw a surrealistic scene. Storm cloud remnants swirled around nearby peaks, creating backlit halos as Denali floated behind, swathed in a deep blue radiance. I watched for several minutes as the subdued shades shifted. The storm was over. Suddenly, I had a deep desire to get going, not tomorrow, but now. The others were already sacked out, but I reasoned that if they understood the beauty outside, they would jump up and we could make the pass in a few hours. This was speech time. Ahem, I began simply as I peered out for inspiration. You guys gotta see this. I can see all the way up the glacier. I can also see Kahiltna Dome and Mount Crossan, and beyond Crossan, beautiful Alpenglow is bathing Foraker. I can see the Kahiltna peaks with cotton candy clouds on them, and beyond that I can see Denali. The Great One is clear and beautiful in its stark, snowy loneliness. In short, gentlemen, the storm is over. If we start now, we can be at the pass in a few hours. Finally, I paused for dramatic effect. When I received no response, I looked back into the tent. Gentle snoring wafted up to greet me. I had only succeeded in lulling them to sleep with my speech. Chagrined, I tried a more direct approach. Hey, heroes, we've got to get going now. It's clear out. Springate stirred and mumbled, Shut up, Roach. We're trying to sleep. We'll get going in the morning. He cinched up the drawstring on his sleeping bag hood and rolled over. As the snoring increased, I peered back out at the fading glory, felt a lump in my throat, and wondered if I was the only one up here who wanted to climb this mountain. Up to this point, our grand adventure had been fun-filled. However, this was the Great One, and I knew that our real test was much higher on the upper mountain. I was eager to be there, but also concerned, even terrified, at what we might find. Denali had already demonstrated great power, and it was clear that the mountain could snuff us out in a second, especially if we offered it a momentary negligence. Yet powerful urges drove me upward toward the unknown heights. I believed that we were simply not going to make a mistake that would turn us around down low. I was nearly dead wrong in that assessment. The unknown can be both terrifying and joyous at the same time. I watched the long Alaskan twilight until a deep blue gripped the glacier, and the heights reflected a lighter azure. Leftover moisture condensed in the cold air, and tiny crystals floated down through the frigid sky. If I listened carefully, I could just hear them tinkling on the tent. After my eyebrows sagged below the vent, I lay down, snuggled into my sleeping bag, and fell asleep instantly. Kahiltna Pass! I woke the next morning to Dick's sarcastic voice. Wake up, Roach. It's so very delicately clear, and we've just got to get going right now. I guess I deserved it. I probably shouldn't have put in the part about the stark, snowy loneliness. Nevertheless, today was our fifth day, and we were still trying to reach Gehiltna Pass. McGowan had won, and worse yet, we would have to face him at Gehiltna Pass. During breakfast, we looked up the glacier, and to our surprise, saw eight figures descending on skis. We assumed that it was either the McGowan party or the four-man Canadian team that we knew to be ahead of us on the West Buttress route, but it was neither. When the large group skied into our camp, Hans Moser introduced himself, and we quickly heard their incredible story. This team of six Canadians and two Americans were descending the lower West Buttress route after having made the first ascent of Denali's Wickersham Wall. The Moser team had climbed the wall's western edge, and three of the party had made it to the top of Denali's North Peak, which we knew to be 850 feet lower than the South Peak. After fighting the storm that had held us in Sheldon's hangar, they traversed to the top of the West Buttress and descended with McGowan's party to Gehiltna Pass. They were now bolting for the Southeast Fork and the pleasures of Talkeetna. Turning to our own task, we were worried about finding our cache in all the new snow, since our tracks and wands from 2 days ago had disappeared. Following Moser's trail, which was different from our earlier trail, we pushed up the glacier as fast as we could. It socked in at 9,000 feet right on cue, but this time we were determined to reach Gehiltna Pass. Finally, we found Sheldon's cub tracks, so we knew we were close to the camps at the pass. When we decided that we must be near the McGowan camp, we pitched our tent in a whiteout at 9,800 feet. Gehiltna Pass, at 10,300 feet, separates the southward flowing Gehiltna Glacier from the Peters Glacier, which flows northeast. The West Buttress route doesn't cross Gehiltna Pass, but takes a hard right just below the pass and climbs onto Denali slopes for the first time. Denali's summit is 5 miles east of Gehiltna Pass, but even at this significant distance, we still felt close to the Great One. The next morning was clear, and I had fun rousting Dick from his bag with a hearty hero's yodel. Squinting in the sun, we saw the West Buttress up close for the first time. It was a large triangular rock face flecked with patches of hard snow. We knew that the top of the face, which hid Denali's upper slopes, was at 16,000 feet. It loomed over us just as impressively as Hunter had from our landing camp, and this was just the shoulder of the Great One. Little by little, Denali was revealing his secrets. We also saw McGowan's camp a few hundred yards away. Tom Nash, one of the guides, came over to our camp and told their troubled tale. I think that he was glad to have some fresh people to talk to. They had cached their snowshoes near here at 10,000 feet, then climbed above Gehiltna Pass on hard snow. After locating a camp above the headwall at 16,200 feet, the now famous 5-day storm hit. After the storm, they were out of food and energy, and one team member had serious frostbite. They descended to 14,200 feet and discovered 12 feet of new snow. With no choice, they plowed down without snowshoes. To make matters worse, when they got to Gehiltna Pass, they couldn't find their cache. It was now days later, and they still didn't have any snowshoes. They were almost out of food, and the expedition was in disarray. The morning that Sheldon had flown over our camp, he landed at their Gehiltna Pass camp with much-needed food supplies. Unable to take off, Sheldon spent 2 days on the glacier, sitting out the most recent storm. He had only gotten off the glacier this morning after mumbling, "Gehiltna Pass is a bad spot for a pickup, you bet." Nevertheless, knowing Sheldon, I figured that he was chuckling when he said it. McGowan's team had still not found their cache, so we lent Tom our collapsible avalanche probe. He probed a huge area looking for several thousand dollars worth of equipment, but they never found the cache. After probing for 2 days, Tom had tears in his eyes. When we talked to McGowan, he never said anything about how long it had taken us to reach Gehiltna Pass, since the mountain had hit him much harder than it had hit us. We still had to descend and find our cache. After talking with the McGowan team, we got a late start, but finally zoomed off around noon. We broke a new trail down the glacier for 2 miles to the area where we knew the cache was, but there was no sign of it. The stark, snowy loneliness stretched to the edge of the glacier in every direction. We had cached in a whiteout with no landmarks to help us. Now we had to spot our 7-foot wand, or we, too, were going to end up a crying, probing failure. It tugged at me that perhaps there was a scenario that could turn us around down low. We went to the most probable spot and walked in an ever-widening spiral for over an hour without success. Then it started socking in again. This was getting damn embarrassing. If anyone found these tracks, they would surely form a dim opinion of the track team. More importantly, we only had a few minutes left before we were in a complete whiteout. We stopped and stared into the gathering gloom, looking for the wand. We stared hard. This was Joff's day. His eagle eye spotted something, and he hollered, "There it is!" The rest of us looked where he pointed, but couldn't see it. Joff took off at an all-out snowshoe trot, hollering insistently, "Follow me! We have to get to it before it socks in!" After 200 yards, we couldn't see anything, but Joff kept going into the whiteout on his chosen bearing. We could only go like this for a minute or two before Joff would lose the line. There was no time for the compass, and I didn't have a bearing anyway, so we just ran into the white, snowy loneliness. We ran hard. Then we stopped. There, at Joff's feet, was the top 3 inches of our precious wand. We were only 3 inches from crying, probing failure, and only the simple act of taping 2 wands together and Joff's eagle eye had saved us. Our most probable spot was off by 200 yards, which was not much in this huge place. One more storm would have committed our success and perhaps even survival to the Kahiltna's eternal snows. We quickly dug down 6 feet and retrieved our vital food cans. Feeling like a cat that had just caught a bird, we marched back to camp with our precious find. It had taken us 6 days to get everything to Kahiltna Pass, and we had been so sure that we could do it in one. We had heard many first-person horror stories and were taking copious mental notes. We were learning fast, as Denali easily lived up to its reputation. June 26 dawned clear, and the Kahiltna Pass camps buzzed with activity. Sheldon flew in and landed with snowshoes for the McGowan party. Then he loaded the frostbite victim into the Cub and managed to take off with another spirited push from the track team. That was before breakfast. After breakfast, we left to carry our advance relay up to 12,400 feet under the West Buttress. The slopes between Kahiltna Pass and the West Buttress were significantly steeper than anything on the Kahiltna Glacier. The snow was deep, so we continued to use our snowshoes, but for the first time we put on our grousers. The plates gave us good traction, but they were too long. Mike put on the best show as he kept dripping, slipping, and doing painful face plants into the deep powder. Mike usually won his races, and he hated slowing the team, especially since the rest of us barely controlled our smirks while he wallowed about trying to get back up. During each thrashing, Mike's cursing rose in intensity until the air around us turned blue. His awful oaths reached the heights, but Denali simply echoed the sentiments back to us. We were the ones struggling here. Finally, we stopped, took the traction plates off, and just left the bolts sticking down. Thus, we created baby grousers, and they worked much better. Their traction was sufficient, and we didn't trip anymore. And soon the track team was again moving gracefully uphill. We reached 12,400 feet and cached our loads. After our near disaster with the glacier cast, we marked this stash with multiple triple wands, then feasted on raisins and the beautiful view. Foraker, rising behind and much higher than Crossan, drew my eye as usual, while the impassive West Buttress soared far above us. The northern view opened for the first time, so Joff and I looked down on the upper part of the Peters Glacier that flows under the Wickersham Wall. Beyond the Peters, holes in the clouds below us revealed the Alaskan tundra, where dozens of small lakes reflecting low sunlight dappled the distant green carpet. The sight of white mountains, open water, and distant wilderness tugged at my emotions, and our climb now had a growing sentience. Descending back to camp, I felt strong, lucky to be alive, and exalted to be here in the white open wilderness, or the WOW, as I now called it. That night, the weather clobbered up. By morning, it was snowing heavily, and we couldn't see anything. This was a real storm, so we hunkered down. McGowan's party had descended before the storm started, but a four-man Canadian team was now in camp with us. They had reached the summit on June 20 and were now descending. We enjoyed talking to them during the leisure hours that the storm forced on us, and they gave us good information. One of the Canadians had frostbite on his hand, so we got our first close-up look at a frostbite blister. They had also lost their snowshoes in the big storm. Everybody descending the mountain had quite a story to tell, and we couldn't help wondering how our story would end up. It was not a violent storm, but it moved into a second day and snowed hard enough to threaten the tents. After shoveling out the camp, we cut up our paperback books, passed around the pieces, and read everything at the same time. We had to be careful not to reveal the endings, but usually whodunit was common knowledge before the fourth guy finished. We read fast, since we would not carry our finished tomes any further. When we got hungry, the conversation turned, as it always does, from adventure to food. In particular, we talked about what we would eat when we got back to Talkeetna. For now, all we could do was sample the various goodies that we had scoured from the McGowan and Canadian teams. A goodie was as simple as a bag of lemon drops or as glorious as a package of black bread. We knew that it was important to keep our energy and spirits up while we were still low on the mountain, since the higher altitudes would reduce our appetites. Nevertheless, after 3 days of sitting in the tent, we were eager to quit yakking and face the test. Alone on the mountain. After depositing 3 feet of new snow, the storm relented on June 30. With all our sopped-up energy, we prepared to go like jackrabbits. Before we launched, Sheldon flew over and dropped snowshoes for the Canadians, who quickly packed up and descended. We were now alone and would not see another person or plane until the end of our climb. One of the joys of climbing Denali in 1963 was that we had the upper mountain to ourselves. We had heard the horror stories, seen people probing for lost caches, relying on Sheldon for emergency airdrops, then flying out with frostbite. Our apprenticeship was over. It was now our turn. We had our experience, our passion, and our plan. We figured that we could be on top in 6 days. We carried our camp to our cache at 12,400 feet and kept going. At 13,200 feet, we reached the famous Windy Corner, where the route sneaks around the lower end of the West Buttress. We thought about camping here, but remembering a story that McGowan told about 6 out of 7 tents failing in a storm at this windy spot, we kept going. The weather socked in, but we just plodded on into the whiteout. I led, straining to see the crevasses that I knew were on the slopes above Windy Corner. On a traverse, I spotted one 10 feet in front of me, so I stopped instantly and hollered, "Whoa, crevasse!" There was another one below me. I started slowly forward and out of the corner of my eye saw something suspicious on my right. I quickly backed up, shouting, "Back! Back up!" What had at first appeared to be a crevasse below me shifted when I moved until I realized that I was on the edge of a big drop-off. I was off route and couldn't see anyone behind me, so I just yelled back into the gloom, "There's a big crevasse network here! Have Dick lead through from the rear on a new line higher up to the left. Be careful." We snaked around and reversed the rope. Dick got past the first crevasse higher up, then spotted another one. Now it was Dick's turn to holler back into the gloom. "I've got another crevasse. There's an old wand in the middle of a snow bridge, and I'm going for it. Keep the rope tight." We inched forward. When Dick was in the middle of the bridge, the snow fell away under his snowshoes until he stared into a black hole at least 60 feet deep. The old wand tinkled down into the blackness. Dick froze, supported only by the front few inches and long tails of his snowshoes. Should he go forward or back? While he made up his mind, he thundered, "Yow! Keep deep hole! Keep the rope tight!" We had a mission to climb this mountain, so Dick decided to lunge forward. The rest of the bridge broke away as he made his move, and his legs started down into the abyss. But Dick was strong, and gravity was not going to take him so easily. With most of his upper body on the far side, he jammed in his ice axe, out-muscled the obstacle, and crawled up on the other side. All we heard in the rear was a protracted "Arrgh!" After Dick caught his breath, we found and crossed a better bridge still higher on the slope. Dick led for another 400 yards into the persistent whiteout, then stopped at the edge of another crevasse. We had all had enough of this dangerous game, so I yelled, "Hey, heroes, what's for dinner?" That did it. We dug out a deep platform and pitched our tent on the spot. My altimeter read 13,700 feet. We had chicken noodle soup, a huge spaghetti feast complete with Parmesan cheese and banana cream pudding for dessert. The next morning, Dick said, "If we work like demons, we can move everything up to 14.2 today." After pondering this for a moment, I replied, "How about splitting up into two teams of two, and each team does a double carry?" Mike boasted, "No double carry, we'll just carry big packs and do it in one trip." "Mike," Joff reminded, "the last time you had a killer pack on, you spent a lot of time on your face. You'll need more than baby grousers today." In a poor attempt to keep the peace, I replied, "Okay, I'll go down with Mike. You heroes move camp up. Just have soup ready for us when we arrive with the killer packs." The wind blew 60 miles per hour as Mike and I went down around Windy Corner, and it was at our backs while we descended to the cache. Could the two of us make good on our boast and carry four loads? The wind had blown the formerly copious new snow away, leaving only blue ice and a few rocks. Mike and I struggled in the wind for an hour to get our packs loaded for the big carry. We couldn't set anything down or it would blow away. When ready, our packs weighed 110 pounds apiece. Even helping each other, we barely got them on our backs. We staggered slowly upward into the wind, taking one step at a time, then bracing and balancing ourselves. I expended most of my energy fighting the wind and had little energy left for upward movement. Worse, rime ice formed on the rope until it dragged along behind me like a pipe of pinnace. When I floundered in the breakable crust, it was my turn to hurl oaths at the impassive buttress. Somehow we made it up to Windy Corner, where we promptly collapsed. Mike tried to convince me that we could make it up with everything, but I talked him out of it. "We have to be smart, Mike. If one of us falls in a crevasse with a killer pack on, we'll be in big trouble. Why do you think it's called a killer pack? This is a long race, buddy. No sense dying just to make good on a stupid boast." This logic, plus a final look at his pack, convinced him. I took the extra food cans off our packs and carefully cached them in the rocks. At least we had brought them up part of the way. Then, dodging the crevasses that had plagued us the evening before, we continued up with mere 90-pound packs to our new camp at 14,200 feet. We dropped our semi-killer packs into the powder, then plopped on them to remove our crampons. This was our toughest day so far, and we needed no further boastful banter. The mountain was teaching us a lot, but there was still much mountain above us. Voices. Joff emerged from the tent with chicken noodle soup, and we remained perched on our packs through dinner as the growing beauty slabbed us. We watched elusive hues dance and play on the peaks in the long Alaskan twilight that never becomes night. Pulling on our down parkas against the growing cold, we watched as Hunter's twin summits nudged Denali's long shadows. Foraker passed through a colorful kaleidoscope in the lowering sun before settling into a deep blue. We could not faithfully reproduce these colors with our cameras, so we just photographed the scene with our eyes. I looked at my teammates and said, "We've come to a fairyland, lads." When the cold crept inside my parka, I crawled into the tent and drifted into a dreamless sleep. The next day we split up again. Joff and Mike went down for the food cans at Windy Corner, while Dick and I broke a trail through new snow up the much-talked-about headwall between 14,200 feet at the top of the West Buttress at 16,200 feet. At 45 degrees, the upper headwall is the steepest part of the West Buttress route. Since our baby grousers were no match for a 45-degree slope, we left our snowshoes at 14,200 feet. Our worst fear was that the headwall would be an ice sheet, but instead, Dick and I sank up to our knees with each step. We alternated leads every three wands, but after three leads, Dick pooped out, so I led the rest of the way. After 5.5 hours of exhausting work, we reached the top of the West Buttress. There, for the first time, we felt Denali's cold nipping at our toes. So our first chore was to warm up Dick's feet. Even with no wind and the sun shining, our feet had been buried deep in the steps where the temperature was much lower. Dick and I wore a civilian version of military mouse boots. The original thickly insulated rubber mouse boots are effective on Denali, but we were not sure about our cheap imitations. McGowan had looked at them and proclaimed them okay, but sitting at 16,200 feet trying to warm Dick's feet, Dick was not so sure. While Dick sat in the sun, I dug our precious cargo into a secure cache. While we worked, we enjoyed a jewel-studded scene to the north, where still peeking through the clouds, thousands of tiny tundra lakes reflected the sun in concert. Like the ending of a Bach chorale, it was fundamental. We felt empowered, and with summit fever surging, we wanted to go higher. When I saw Dick looking up at the route ahead, I said, "We can be back here tomorrow and be on top the day after that. Soon, buddy, soon." That evening, with all our loads above Windy Corner and an advanced relay at 16,200 feet, I finally felt committed to Denali. With the Kehiltna Glacier well below us now, the lower world faded in our minds as the climb became consuming. After dinner, Joff pulled me aside and said, "Hey, bro, you and I gotta climb together on the summit push. It's time for the summit club to swing into action. We're going to need all our climbing instincts up there, and we'll be stronger as a team if you and I go first." Joff was right. It was time to marshal and organize our strengths. The crevasse danger was less on the upper mountain, so we decided to climb on two ropes of two. Joff and I would go first and alternate leading. An expedition to climb a great mountain develops a certain life of its own. As the expedition ascends, it starts to move with an energy that is greater than the sum of its members' passions. In short, it develops momentum. One of life's extant experiences is to be on an expedition where the energy is positive, and the momentum is always accelerating toward the summit. In spite of a million variables, most expeditions preordain their success or failure long before summit day. We didn't know it yet, but we had created positive momentum. It didn't have anything to do with banter and boasts. The way we did it was by each of us carrying just a little more than his share. The difference between a little more and a little less than your share is trivial, but that small difference controls an expedition's spirit. In the middle of the night, I lay in my bag listening to the signature of the wind that I knew was filling in our tracks up the headwall. I knew Joff and I would do the exhausting lead up the headwall again, but this time we would continue up to our high camp at 17,200 feet. Then it was summit day. We would be starting in a few hours. Could we do it? Out of my inner night space, a line popped into my head from Mendelssohn's Elijah. Then we shall see whose God is God the Lord. The morning was clear and bright. We were now above any clouds, and good weather was settling in on the upper mountain. Trimming our supplies for the summit push, we left behind our snowshoes, some food, fuel, and our spare gas stove. We would rely on the two butane cartridge stoves that we had used up to this point. To make sure that we could find our cache at 14,200 feet, we marked it with a compact snow pyramid 10 feet high. Then we took 30 wands, taped together several multi-stage monsters, and jammed a 12-foot wand onto the 10-foot pyramid and placed other monster wands around it. There would be no crying, probing failure here. I led up the slope for an hour, postulating up to my knees with every step. When I got disgusted with the deep snow, Joff came striding by fresh as a well-napped lion and led for another hour while I followed easily in his steps. When Joff slowed slightly, I charged ahead and led for another hour and a half. Joff polished off the steep part of the wall with another 45-minute lead. When Joff and I convened on the ridge at 16,200 feet, I said, "This is the old Summit Club teamwork." Joff replied, "We knocked more than an hour off yesterday's time." Mike and Dick soon joined us, and we fell into our usual banter. Things were going well when we were in banter mode, and I considered that trouble lurked when we fell silent. One thing we did not have trouble with was the altitude. We all felt fine. Our spirits were soaring, and the weather was still perfect. We were 24 hours from the summit. The route above 16,200 feet follows the crest of the upper west buttress for 1,000 feet to a small plateau at 17,200 feet, where we plan to place our high camp. This is the route's most spectacular section, and the views were indeed stunning. I led up the ridge as afternoon slipped slowly into evening. The temperature dropped to minus 10 degrees, and the outer world fell farther below us. My crampon squeaked as I crunched up the hard, wind-packed snow. The cold, clear, still air tingled with an intensity that I had never experienced before. Suddenly, alpenglow bathed the upper mountain, infusing the snow with intense color. A deep red was below us, at our feet, high above, and somehow in the air. We climbed on into a fairyland that photographers would turn triple flips for just to see from below. But this time we were in the photo. I looked at my boots, and seeing the color in my footsteps, I felt as if God was embracing this mountain for a few special moments. We did not need to speak, but did stop to stare at the splendor and let it embrace us. It was beyond human power. Too soon, the glaciers and lowlands dissolved into darkness far below us, and only the highest peaks remained in the alpenglow. We now felt completely detached from the lower world as our eyes wandered over the surreal scene of red summits, pink skies, and beyond, the black of space. Joff, Dick, and Mike stood poised behind me on the ridge. Beyond my companions, I saw only one other peak that rose high enough to remain in the hand of God. It was Foraker, Denali's queen. While the alpenglow bathed Foraker's north face, I noticed a long, straight ridge radiating upwards in the center of the face. This beautiful ridge drew my eye directly to the Queen's summit, and I knew that I had discovered my future Foraker route. In that instant, I understood that Denali was only a beginning. It would always have to touch great peaks. In the next instant, a strong voice spoke directly in my mind. "Don't have an accident." Was this my old brain voice, a warning from God? 3 seconds later, I heard Dick bellow, "Oh no, 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 stop!" to see Dick dash behind a boulder and assumed that Mike had fallen off the ridge. Fear stabbed at my sternum. Then I saw Mike running after Dick, so they were both fine. What on earth was the matter? As Joff and I raced down, we knew that it was still big trouble. At first, we didn't see what was wrong. Then Mike ran up wild-eyed, hollering, "My pack! My pack fell off the ridge!" Stay tuned for the exciting conclusion in part 3.